Hello, I'm John Waters, and I'm supposed to announce there is no smoking in this theater, which I think is one of the most ridiculous things I've ever heard of in my life. How can anyone sit through a length of a film, and especially a European film, and not have a cigarette? But don't you wish you had one right now? And I'm telling you, smoke anyway. It gives ushers jobs. And if people didn't smoke, there would be no employment for the youth of today. So once again, no smoking in this theater.
Blast off.
You know what? I should have done? I don't know why I'm just thinking this. Taken even one of the beast noises that he makes, those like shrieking falcon sounds. Those would have been
he
so
makes
fucking
just,
good as sound
just
effects.
Irregularly enough that they rule every single time he does it. And I'm like, holy
times,
shit.
I have timestamps on each one in my phone because I was like, this is way too fucking funny that like I can imagine these trimmed together. Be really good.
Yeah. I am glad that he did them right like three times. Like the rule of threes for animal noises in movies. Like they knew what they were doing.
Here's a weird thing. At the whole time I was watching this, I think it's maybe just because it's hashtag the year of Dan Stevens. I could not stop thinking about how much like a roided up, like 100 pounds heavier Dan Stevens would crush this role in like a remake.
Oh,
like he would bring just the right, like zany, like quirky energy. You know how this guy's constantly going for like a little bit offbeat and charming and he really misses it like 99% of the time. I feel like Dan would just smash it. Like you would be, he'd be so perfect as like super buff, charming, and a little bit of a little freak who's like really into animals. That's my dream casting now.
Yeah. Mark Singer, like, especially in his character's introduction, I'm not going to say the character's name because
he's so good
break
at this.
A sacred rule,
a professional,
or something like that. But the fact that he, him like smiling at like weirdly inopportune moments, like Dan Stevens thinking about like Legion in particular, it's a fit. That's all we're saying.
Yeah,
there's something there.
There's something about this performance being just like way off bullseye just about every time that reminded me that like you could almost make an actor who's good at that make it really impactful. Unfortunately, in my humble opinion, Mark Singer does not fit the category, but we'll talk about it. We'll talk about
we will.
Right now.
Right now on Trilove, a literal roundtable podcast about movies we saw or people we met at or through the Trilon Cinema in Minneapolis, Minnesota. You can find us on Twitter at Trilove Podcast and find the Trilon itself. It's a cool cinema in South Minneapolis. On Twitter at Trilon Cinema and at Trilon.org. That's also where you can get tickets and join the membership club and get merchandise, posters for most of the series they've ever hosted in the last umpteen years that they've been a theater. Check it all out at Trilon.org. But check out this episode you're about to listen to right now from me. I'm Jason Daphnis. I'm a coward, and you can find me on Twitter at Nintendoofus.
I'm a ferret named Cody, and you can find me on Blue Sky at Cody Narvison.
You probably know me as the Podmaster, but you can call me Harry Mackin, and I'm on Twitter at PunishTake.
Today's film played as part of the Swords and Sorcery series at the Trilon. I believe it will be over by the time that you listen to this episode, but hey, you can go back in the programming and find out exactly what we talked about from the series and find all the movies that played at Trilon.org. Today's film is going to be discussed without the help of Aaron Grossman, but I have licensed under exclusive permissions from AG Enterprises Limited, the patented Aaron Grossman summary, which because of his context right now, I'm not allowed to exactly, there's a weird clause in the contract I signed where I can't actually play the sound bit that I usually play, but I am authorized to, in the tongue in which he would should be speaking right now, introduce his own segment with a calm, cool, sí, de hecho, amigos. Thank you very much, everybody, for the bit.
our lawyer is listening to this with gritted teeth. You're treading on thin ice, pal.
Fine-toothed comb.
Matt Yost, our lawyer, is listening to this with gritted teeth.
Actually,
I mean, I would go to Matt Yost for legal advice about the pod. But not today because we got a movie to talk about. And that movie is The Beastmaster. It's a 1982 fantasy action movie directed by Don Coscarelli, best known for the Phantasm films. Yeah, that's right. Hashtag the ball is back. I went back to your reviews.
The ball
of those
is back,
movies,
baby.
I forgot that you.
It's
logged
one of my favorite tagline of all time.
I forgot that you logged like both of those movies that you saw at the horror-thons with The Ball is Back, even though it's just for the second one. Incredible tagline. Written by Coscarelli and Paul Pepperman, loosely based on the novel of the same name, though the novel has a space between those two words, Beast and Master. I had to call it out. by Andre Norton, which is the pen name of pulp author Alice Mary Norton. Apparently, she was highly regarded in the world of science fiction and pulp novels. So maybe check out her work instead of this movie. We'll get into exactly why. Mark Singer, I didn't even put his last name, plays Dar, who is heir to the throne of Arak, born with the power to communicate with animals after being prematurely taken from the womb by the evil priest Max,
implanted in a cow's stomach instead, right? Which then she performs C-section on to get him out. That's a wild fucking scene. Maybe we'll get
there. It is a very strange plot element that, like, I don't know, to even call it like part of that.
Do you think that's why he got his powers? By the way,
there's a whole part of this movie that I want to talk about from the lens of like, how much do people really understand about this movie? Yeah, sure. Exactly. I mean, that is just one manifestation of it. But yes, like, he's implanted in a cow, and he's actually born from the body of the cow, physically brought into the world.
Hardcore Macbeth. Symbolism at the beginning of this movie. Like, why didn't they say that he would be killed by a man who was born of a cow? Because that would have been really good. And in keeping with the, like, mythos.
That would have been so much fun. But as it actually happens, he is torn from the womb by the evil priest Mayax. I keep saying Max because that's how it's fucking spelled. It's such a stupid-ass name. Mayax, played by Rip Torn,
There are two A's in it, for what it's worth, Jason.
But there's no... How do you not say anything?
Each of them in their own syllable?
TJ Maxx.
It really rules that, like, both all of the names in this movie are, like, one syllable, and all of the acting in this movie is... monosyllabic in its own way, shall we say. And so, like, it's constantly a lot of people just being like, durr, durr, durr. And it's like, I don't know anybody's fucking names, because every time they say them, it's just like, yeah, we got to go to burr with er to get burr.
You know, I kept comparing it, and we'll do this in the podcast, to Conan, because there are a lot of those type names as well. But for some reason, those stick, and for some reason, they don't in here. Let me get through the summary real quick, in which Mayax enlists a couple of his loyal, like, strangely hot-bodied but disfigured-faced witches to, of course, take him from the womb, birth him from the womb of a cow, because Mayax's death has been prophesied at Dar's hands sometime in the future. Dar is saved at the last minute by a wandering farmer who is actually never given a name, just as young Dar's father, I think the person is credited. And after awakening to his powers in adolescence, Dar's people, the Emirites, are slaughtered by Juns, which is the religious sect then led by Mayax. Bent on avenging his adoptive family, Dar uses his powers to befriend, and I had to list the animal names out here. Normally, I know Aaron wouldn't. This is outside of his convention, but I have to because they all have names and they're also important to this movie. We have Sharak the Falcon, which I don't know if that name's ever spoken in the film either. I like control F'd the entire script.
No, definitely not. I didn't even really think that he was part of the proper team. You know what I mean?
Like, but there, again, some big questions starting with the cow thing and leading
the
into
the most important of the animals. At the end, he brings back the fucking bird people, but yeah,
it's so strange. He is also joined by Ruh, a panther, two mischievous ferrets named Kodo and Podo, as he returns to reclaim the throne of Arak, now controlled by Mayax and his fanatical religious hegemony. Along the way, he also befriends Kiri, played by Tanya Roberts, a slave girl, Seth, played by John Amos. I really, really love John Amos wherever he pops up. I have no idea what kind of person he
is. Let's go.
Seth himself, a wandering pilgrim loyal to the dethroned king of Arak.
Ruh, Kodo, and Seth. Seth.
And Tal, another heir to the same throne as Dar. They all play a distant second fiddle, if you ask me, to the actual animal in this movie. But that's a different point of conversation. The Beastmaster itself.
They're also dressed so slutty, including the kid, which always freaked me out. Like, that kid is basically naked. Please cover up the child in this movie.
I know there usually are rules, but there should have been a special rule for this movie that, like, no further than, I don't know, waist high up the thigh, should you be able to see bare skin, like a continuous piece of bare skin?
It was a real monkey's paw, because, like, Tanya Roberts is also basically naked in this movie, and I felt very good about that. And then all of a sudden there was also a child who was basically naked. I didn't feel good about that.
And the movie's like, you like this, do you? Do you like flesh?
Yeah, you little freak.
It was a modest box office success at the time of its release in 1982, pulling roughly $15 million against a budget of $9 million, and spawned two sequels and a spin-off television series, though I don't know how much steam either of those had. And as Harry was intimating before the podcast opened, that HBO series and the film itself got a lot of play ended up with a fun spin on the name HBO that you can actually find a little bit of the origin of in a piece that Michael Popham, former guest on our episode about, I think it was Terror of Mechagodzilla, joined.
He joined for a couple of those, right? A couple of the Godzillas?
I only remember one, but I apologize, Michael.
I think you're probably right. I think it was just one. Sorry, Mike.
That Godzilla, Ishiro Honda's Godzilla series. So Michael Popham wrote a little piece called Hey Beastmasters On, which was the fun shortening, retroactive shortening of the name to Hey Beastmasters On because of how frequently this movie played. It is apparently like a lot of the critical appraisal you'll find about this movie relies on a whole lot of people's nostalgia for it or their like some contemporary derision for it as like, you know, a cash in on the sci-fi fantasy, He-Man genre at the time. I think generally you can discard a lot of that criticism and retroactive like praise as kind of just nostalgic pablum because I'm here to tell you both it's not a very good movie, is it? I don't know if that's like a very friendly way to start the discussion, but I just have to make sure that I'm not alone in thinking that this movie was not very good and that I was not wrong for maybe being tuned out for parts of it. Cody, how did you feel about this movie? Was it your first time? How did you see it and how did it land?
First time seeing it, have no prior mileage with this movie. Watched it at home, couldn't make it to the trial on, unfortunately. At the time of this recording, it is streaming on Prime. So if that's still a thing when this episode drops and you feel like giving Daddy Bezos some pocket change, you can do that.
It's also extremely easy to pirate from Pirate Bay. I don't know why I know this information, but just in case you are of that persuasion, it's easily findable and in very high definition, I must say.
Yeah, I think I got to start getting into the muscle memory of just like archive.org, Pirate Bay, and then, you know, any other option. It is out there. It is commonly available. Jason, to your point, it fits into my sort of the thing that I'll bust out sometimes the characterization rather of like, it's not a masterpiece, but it is like that sort of thing. Like it's not a great, I agree. It's not a particularly great movie. Early goings of this movie in particular, I found it a little challenging to get into at first. Get our footing.
Yeah. I could not stop thinking about how this movie would be so much better if he hooked up with the party like 20 minutes in instead of like an hour and 10 minutes in. It's crazy how long that takes.
Yeah, I fully agree there. That being said, because of the, and this is like maybe a personal sensibility thing for me, like I've tried to communicate this with movies that are similar to this, like similar like genre production design heavy sort of pieces and others that are just like completely of different persuasions. But the choices that are being made are just so like off base enough. We were kind of gesturing at this before getting on mic. But like the fact that this lead is like just like perfectly not charismatic.
It's like a black hole of charisma though, right? It's like he's just off in a way that is like so like it's almost hard to talk about, but it's so apparent. Which is where you can like perfectly see the mirror image of what they want this character to be, and he's just not pulling it off.
Exactly. And I do think there are a lot of like there is a very clear Venn diagram between that we could create ourselves. Honestly, that's probably what some of this episode will be between this and Conan the Barbarian. Yeah. It makes sense that they were both screened at the trial on and Conan being a similar but different thing of like Arnold Schwarzenegger, like pre like sweet spot of charisma. But it is still like engaging to watch
perfect.
kind of like figure that stuff out. Whereas like it never really clicked with this guy for me, but the choices being made, there were enough like oddball choices being made where like I couldn't look away. Like I was top to bottom, I think I was probably more fully engaged with this movie compared to something like Conan, which like the second time around, I think I felt better about it, but like, and maybe it is just like the animal thing, but I'd be maybe a little more prone to revisit this down the line compared to something like Conan, just because I know every 90 seconds there's going to be another like weirdo choice that like gets 60% of the way there, and that's like kind of enough.
Probably deeply irresponsible use of animals that like you think throughout this movie. I kept thinking like, fuck, like I wonder if like these animals were probably real traumatized by the making of this film.
When I think it was Coda, when Coda goes under the sand,
I hate that scene much, dude. Oh my God.
I was so stressed. And when, spoilers for the end of the movie, but when Coda does not, I mean, it's a movie, but when Coda didn't make it out alive, I was so depressed.
I was really pissed about that.
I'm still depressed.
Yeah.
I'm not doing okay. That's not a choice they had to make, also. They could have just like let all the animals live. And
I agree.
Nothing bad would have come of it, as far as our perception of this movie, probably. I don't know. Like, I have a lot of kind of like random stray thoughts about it, but the animals are all stars. They all have their own, like, it's like good animal performances, but it's probably more so like they cut around like the animals doing something perfectly cute at the perfect, like the cat like nonchalantly getting up and walking away through the titular Beastmaster's like sexual maneuverings trying to get with Kira. His cousin, by the way,
No, that's definitely like by the end of the movie, they both know that they are related to one another and definitely mm-hmm. still like romantically entangled. It's just like, it's the end of, it's like Don Coscarelli was going to come out at the end of this and be like, I'm Don Coscarelli and I wrote the incest episode of Community. I wrote the incest episode of Beastmaster.
We had a lot of fun with incest on this week's trial of I don't know, I'm getting to the point of meandering, but Jason, to your original question, not a great movie, still a movie that I feel like generally positively about, even if it's just for the earnest but ill-advised sort of choices that it made along the way. And I'm thrilled that the trial on screen. This is very much like, I would not seek this out otherwise, even though it is like somewhat notable in various like genre circles, but just like, I would not ordinarily seek something like this out. And I'm thrilled that we got the chance to talk about it.
Yeah. No, man,
I just say like, I so suspected watching this movie that Cody was going to feel this way about it, like just a little bit more positive. I think just like more grace toward it. And I'm so glad we get that opinion of it here, because like I think I might be between you and Jason on it. But I'm super interested. Go ahead, Jason, with what you're thinking.
You know, I'm not going to completely rag on it the entire time. It just has such low lows, and like not even that they're offensively bad or that they, you know, like you can see the strings or whatever. It's just, it's active choices made that seem to completely subvert and undermine any like fun fantasy, any like narrative tension, even the camp. Like I've heard it described in some ways as camp. I don't find it that, because it doesn't appear like intentional,
right.
Absolutely. Like even noteworthy in any I don't want to say any respect. Clearly we've already talked a little bit about the animal performances, and truly, I mean, there are a few movies I can think of where I'm more impressed by the screen presence of an animal or two animals that can just simply react like hits perfectly on cue and perfectly as actors.
Well, and like, also just like with the tiger, it's like there's almost a roar level of like, hey, how did they stop that tiger from just mauling the shit out of everybody? Because he's just straight up walking with all the principal actors through scenes.
And then on top of that, it's like, oh, so they survived and the animal didn't do something wrong. But also like they hit their marks so perfectly. There's this shot. It's right after he meets Seth and they're like planning their assault on Arik or whatever to reclaim it. And in the background, Ruth, the panther, is just like very calmly sleeping against like with the warm glow of the fire, and the other animals are in the foreground. And then John Amos sort of struts toward the fire, and it's all perfectly cued, and it's just beautiful. Animal handlers must have really known how to train their animals. Two, I'm pretty sure that there must have been some amount of duress for at least a couple of these animals in a lot of these situations. But three, it just ends up as something convincingly like, you know, if I knew a little bit less about how the world works, I might think these animals understand acting, because it's just so fucking perfect.
No, exactly.
It's
and like,
unbelievable.
And to this movie's great credit, they find so many different ways to use the animals in that way as if they were like actual principal characters, right? Like the worst scene in the movie, right, which Cody alluded to, which is where like Dar kind of like tries to like seduce slash sexually assault slash coerce his cousin into making out with him or whatever. But like the Tiger plays a straight man in that scene. Like a comedic straight man who is like not picking up what Dar is trying to put down. And it works so well. And it's like, wait, does the Tiger understand the comedic timing of this scene? And like, there were two or three sequences that felt like that to me, what you're describing, Jason, where it was just like, it feels like the animals are taking direction in this movie in a way that
Maybe that's the part that gets me the most is that, and you know, the thing that makes me think most negatively of maybe the like, more intentional narrative aspects and more positively about the incidental, oh, they got animals to do these things type moments. I think that becomes important when I realized that, and Harry, what you're saying makes me come to this realization that I think the humans are taking direction the animals are taking direction better than the humans. And maybe the folks who are actually pulling the strings of this movie sort of worked better, understood better, like how animals reacted or how to frame an animal reaction than they did actually to like put information in a sequence or in a structure or like shoot a shot that made a lot of narrative sense. Maybe it's just because it eats up like an undue amount of my respect for this movie is like the animal performances and the integration of animals into the story. But it just really does feel like there was something missing from an incredibly important part of this movie, which was like the story and the people they got to tell it through different, you know, mechanical means, acting and cinematography and set design and, you know, shot composition and everything. And just the fact that they can put the perfectly timed reaction of two ferrets sort of going, and you just in the perfect sequence or like crawling through a little pipe, the stupid simplicity of it is what makes me think, why does this stick with me rather than this really kind of should be epic, like you were saying, Shakespearean, like tale set in the whatever Highlands, thousands and thousands of years ago. Just the fact that none of those things hit, but the animal stuff does so much. It's so dumb, but it makes it feel important in a way to me.
Yeah, well, and it's kind of exactly what you want from this movie, right? Like, it's called The Beastmaster. The sort of differentiating factor, not to use a fucking marketing term, but like, is like, hey, like, this is Conan the Barbarian, but he talks to animals, right? But he's Eliza Thornberry. And it's like, okay, so like, the thing that you're going to do that's going to make this movie stand out is you're going to have animals and they're going to give good performances. And it's like, hey, man, like, for whatever else this movie's successes or failures, it accomplishes that, right? Like, there is great animal footage in this. I think Kodo and Poto are like unequivocally the stars of the movie. Those ferrets have so much fucking charisma. Like every time they're on screen, I had the biggest, dumbest like expression on my face. Which, by the way,
yeah, man.
Yeah, according to the background, like ferrets straight up can't be trained. So like the way they did that is they just like baited them with treats and stuff and just like shot the shit out of them and like did a bunch of shooting. Wow. And it's like, maybe that's the right way to shoot this movie, right? Like maybe you just sort of like, I don't know. But like, then again, like, it's not like the actors didn't understand the assignment. I think Mark Singer understands what he's doing here really well. I think he just doesn't pull it off for whatever reason. But I'm really glad what you got at there, Jason, because for me, I also thought this movie was pretty bad. I don't know. I don't know if it was like the I think I called it the high bigot or the strong bigotry of high expectations. But like, this movie is conflated with Conan a ton. Like both just on the internet and in general, like they played it at the same time for this sequence or at the Trilon. And like they came out at basically the same time. I think this actually predates it by a year, but they might've come out the very same year. And like, to be honest, I think Conan is so much better at this than this movie is, like that there is like no comparison between the two of them. Just in terms of like pretty much every level, like I'm sorry, and like I'm sorry especially to the Phantasm heads. I've never understood that franchise, but I respect people who like it. I don't think our man Don can shoot a movie very well. Lot of this movie is shot reverse shot of like a man's face reacting and then an animal's face and then a man's face and then an animal's face. There's just not a lot of like stylistic choices in this movie in general. And the ones that are there don't work very well. They use the Evil Dead cam, which I like, to show when Dar is like warging into his animals, and seeing through their eyes, but they like put a really dumb, like filter over it that kind of ruins the effect. at least for me, and that felt needless. I don't know. I think that, like you said, Jason, I think maybe this movie's greatest crime is not that much of a crime at all, which is just that it's like, it's just perfectly mediocre, right? Like, I think I would like this movie more if it was better, obviously, but I would like it more if it was worse too. You know what I mean? Like, if it was a little bit weirder and a little bit less, like, right over the plate. But, like, as it is right now, like, you can kind of see why it became such a TV movie, right? Like, and I think that the background material, like the Wikipedia talks about this too, but it's got to be just like, you could pretty much come into this movie whenever you want and not have missed that much, because like the plot is pretty broad and pretty obvious, and you're really there for the animal performances, and you're really there to see some weird shit happen, and some weird shit does happen, right? Like, I think that some of my favorite things about this movie is that it feels like really gloriously 80s, right? In that, like, you know, you're, it feels super like studio built in some ways, but because it's like kind of pre like lockdown studio era, we still get things like the bird people who digest people from the outside. And that's just a major scene in the riddle of this movie that doesn't connect to anything else until it does right at the end. Right. And like, or like the eyeball ring that ends up getting impaled. And then the person's eye is like also fucked up. There's just some, like, there's some good little fantasy isms in this movie. And there are some good animal performances. Mostly though, like, I think the problem with it is that it's boring. I don't remember the last time I was kind of actively bored watching a movie, which, to be fair, I did, like, watch this at a cabin. I watched it in two sittings. Great movie for two sittings, by the way. Works really well. But I brought five movies to the cabin, which was ridiculous because we probably had time for two. But it was like, I brought movies that were on Kelly's watch list. So I brought Perfect Days, the Wim Wenders, The 25th Hour, the Spike Lee movie, Certain Women, Kelly Reichert, and Hero, the Jet Li movie. We didn't watch any of those.
Those are all bangers.
Yeah, they're holy great shit movies. We didn't watch any of those because I was like, all right, but before we watch good movies, like, sorry, like, I'm recording on this movie Beastmaster on Sunday. I have to watch it for the podcast. She's like, that's fine, we can watch it. So we watched Beastmaster this weekend instead of any of those good movies.
And it sapped and, like, womp, all your womp energy.
Yeah, like maybe I'm just sort of, yeah, we couldn't even, like, we started watching it the first night we got there. We got like an hour in, and like, I like wiggled the mouse to see how much time we had, and we were halfway through the movie, and she was like, how is that possible? It feels like we've been watching this movie for 3 hours. And that's just kind of like how this movie feels, right? Is it's just like, I'm sorry, like, it's just not very good. Like, the performances aren't good. I think the cinematography is really, really phoned in. The story is weirdly phoned in and doesn't make a lot of sense the way we'll talk about later. And like, there are a lot of missed opportunities, but I think that part of the reason why, like, this movie, it becomes worthy of attention or talking about anyway, is right, is because despite those missed opportunities, like Cody said, there's a lot of weird and fun stuff here too. And like, that's something, right? Like, I wouldn't necessarily recommend this movie, right? But if you're interested in like weird relics from the 80s, I think that this is weirdly kind of one of the better ones of those, just in that, like, it teaches you a lot about what a kind of like destined for TV movie looked like at that time, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And I, in an attempt to further and better make sense of like my like somewhat positive response to this movie, again, recognizing that it's kind of a turd, a lot of it doesn't really work, I felt myself asking questions, and like I'm trying to like look back on them. I wrote down as many as I could, but like, usually I try to meet a movie at its level. Even so, with this one, I felt myself asking like just like logic based questions.
I got there too, just, and like, I never do yeah, that, right? It like, it's so right, weird, because like, I hate the fucking cinema sins people, right? But like, right, I caught myself being like, hey, why doesn't he like control the horses in that last scene, for instance, or whatever?
Right, this blue suppressing neck juice seems OP. Why are we not seeing that in other scenes? The Beastmaster's father beat a witch with a sword after the witch like thoroughly owned him, just like, you know, like knocked it out of, like, how could a witch lose in single hand-to-hand combat in that particular way? Why did nobody have a flaming arrow at the end of the movie? Why did it have to be like, you know,
dude, Lord of the Rings, oh my God, Two Towers, that bothered me so much.
That was so annoying. They clearly had arrows. Like, why didn't they just light one on fire and shoot it? Why? The biggest one for me is why would you bring your child to a child burning ceremony? I feel like that's just asking for trouble. Like, so many of these things just did not make sense to me. But those were weird, like those pockets of uncertainty and just like amused kind of confusion on my part, like me kind of patting a dumb dog on the head and be like, you little idiot. We're buoyed by these sequences, or even if they weren't full sequences, and we've touched on a few of them already, that just seemed like very self-assured in their own, like in the Beastmaster sort of way. Like weirdly, they're threading the needle with just the swing, these swings at like things that they would say, call or like quote unquote, they're adult or they're mature or something like that. The, like going back to Dar's village and seeing wreckage. There was like a topless woman running around during that sequence, during a movie that is like otherwise, I mean, like there are animals being cute in it. It's just like, are you trying to, like, is this going for, like a section of the art? Like, does this movie imagine, or do the people behind this movie imagine the viewers are going to be largely comprised of children? I realize this was an age like before PG-13, so like maybe that's, or the PG-13 rating rather, so
no, you're
maybe
right, that plays though, into it, because it's like kind of a Skinamax movie at some points, especially where Tanya right. Roberts is concerned, but also like it's about a cool muscled hero who talks to animals, and it's sort of like, wait right. a minute, like those things seem fundamentally in misalignment.
Exactly. Yeah. Nevertheless, like there's some pretty graphic, carnage at like him moving like dead bodies around. Just like, that's not something, not to just like chalk it up to this, but like, that's not something you would see in like a lot of, similarly inclined movies nowadays. And I'm doing a boomer shrug. The Eagle Dementors or whatever the fuck those things were. I knew if I watched this as a kid, and I watched
those.
If I'd watched this movie when I was a kid, those fuckers would have destroyed me.
Eagle Dementors is such a good word for that. Also, I love how even within the auspices of the movie, everybody considers them like as freaky as we do. We're like, they come to save the day. And even as they're saving the day, Dar is like, hey, let's get the fuck out of here. Because he's so freaked out by the fact that these things exist. It's just like, what is happening here?
Right. He and I both. And even if the lines, there were some lines that I thought went like kind of hard, even if the lines didn't nail it, some like sentiments that I thought that I wouldn't have expected from something like somebody asks, if it was Seth or some other character who's just like, oh, is that cat your friend? I don't think it was Seth. I think it was I'm forgetting everybody's name. She's like, basically somebody asked Dar if like that cat is like his or like
his, right. He's like, are you the owner of this animal?
Yeah. And he says something like kind of cool. He's just like, we fight together sometimes.
We fight just together like sometimes, like, dude. I like,
which is so chill and cool.
I was like, fuck yeah. Like, that's right. Like, that's how I feel about pets at their best. Right. It's like, oh, you're like a cool roommate that I like am chill right. with. Like, there's not an owning situation happening here.
Of course. And then like a few exchanges later, something to the effect, it was just like, life is a circle, you know, like we'll meet each other again. And then like immediately, like they team up again immediately. But just like those sort of like those sentiments where this movie is like seeing itself for what it is. And just like we're going to nail the, or like we're in our mind, we're going to try and nail all of these like specific characterizations and sentiments. And there are a few in particular that I think like transcend the goofiness and like the swing and a miss that is a lot of this movie. Just like, I don't know, those things sort of like buoyed against one another made for, like a worthwhile push and pull, at least from, obviously your mileage may vary. And like eternal disclaimer of like, I'm the type of dude who within the last calendar year rewatched, Babe, a movie that I grew up on. I rewatched Babe on an airplane for the first time in like 15 years. I cried 3 times and I gave it 5 stars on Letterboxd.
Babe's an amazing movie though.
I'm an easy sell for animals doing cute shit is what I'm trying to say. Any shortcomings, that like this movie has, and there are plenty. I feel there's some of those are softened by the way that these other sorts of things, these more like the tonal mismatch, the like, who is this for type of question. Some of that seeps into this movie in positive ways for me. I don't know if that hits you in the same way, Jason, but that's, again, this is me trying to like make sense of why why this is such a strange movie and why anybody could possibly come away from this being like, I would like, I found myself enjoying it, would maybe enjoy it again someday, maybe. Maybe on a double go with Conan, as is the fashion.
For sure. I mean, I would even at this point watch some elements of the like diaspora of this movie. I would end up watching like the goofy sequel where he ends up in like modern times. That sounds like a ridiculous enough spin. Like it can't be enough spin.
The TV series, if the TV series is like the show, the movie where it's just like, hey, every episode we're going to find some kind of interesting, unique way for him to use his Beastmaster powers.
Right.
I'd be kind of into that, right? Like there's that one scene where he gets blinded and he has to beat the witch by seeing through the eyes, like in fucking Dune Messiah of... like his tiger. Like I was like, oh, that's cool. Like they're actually finding a lot of cool different ways to use these powers.
There are
right?
there but, are little ideas. And I will say that was like the turning point was as soon as it becomes clear that like he has some dominion with animals, some like communion, we'll say, was like a turning point for me in this movie. Unfortunately, it does like you said, his consorting with humans becomes like an hour or so into the movie. His consorting with animals becomes like very explicitly part of the plot, somewhat sooner than that, but not soon enough to make me like right on board from the beginning. There are some cool things. I mean, I will say like even just as simple as during one of those fights, I think it's during when the Juns are like taking over slaughtering his people. He blocks an arrow with a shield. It pokes through. He turns the shield around and then impales a guy with the
stuff.
It's a fucking incredible decision.
I wrote that down. It's rules.
So goddamn cool. And then in that same scene, and this is why I think Don Coscarelli is maybe just like not. He was just not good at his job because
maybe he doesn't have the juice
because like there's moments like that, which I assume like maybe he had a hand in shaping. Maybe like it was part of stunt court, whatever.
Oh, I mean, his name appears three times in the credits, right?
It's he's definitely it's all like over this. Yeah.
Produced, written by, directed by all of that.
And then in that same fight scene, there's a shot irrespective of whatever else is going on in the scene. Obviously it's slaughter. But there's a shot of a guy just falling off the battlements, slow-mo, for maybe 10 full seconds in the middle of like a heated battle, in the middle of when our hero is down, when the animals are like his dog, Toto, I think, is pulling him away from the battle after being mortally wounded. Like it's kind of a tense moment. And then just, a guy falling for 10 seconds. And it's like, what the fuck were we doing here? Like an editor, a cinematographer, and a director all needed to say this was the right thing to do, or maybe somebody got overwritten. And it just feels like, maybe by committee, or maybe Don Coscarelli, just not very good at his job, decided that that's how it needed to play in the moment. Okay, whatever, fine. The thing that sealed for me that maybe Don Coscarelli, maybe just not very good at his job, or maybe again, this got, you know, QA'd into submission.
Oh man, the fan heads are going to come after us for this episode.
We'll see. I will say, knowing that he did the Phantasm movies, sort of,
it makes so much sense, right? Oh my God, the ball is back.
They're in the middle of a pretty cool scene where they're storming Uruk and they're about to get to Zed. And of course, Dar does not know who Zed is because he was taken from his father too early and Zed is blinded. So he's not going to be able to recognize his son. Ah, and you get the dramatic tension. They're headed into the cell. They can see Zed from outside the door. And then for some reason, Dar turns around, walks down a hallway suspiciously. A bad guy is standing there. And then the bad guy dies at the teeth of the panther. And then they turn around and they continue the scene. And it's like, what the fuck were we doing here? I just get so fucking frustrated in the moment by why did we have that? Why did we undercut this moment with like it didn't have the same heft that just continuing the scene would have. Maybe it padded time a little bit. And those are moments where like, oh, the craft maybe is not quite on point. But even like, I swear to God, this is in the same vein as my other criticisms in that like there's just something from concept to execution that seems to have lost its way. But I'm sure you remember at the beginning where young Dar saves his adoptive father. Again, a character with no name. I think Ben Hammer might be the actor's name.
He's a ridiculously bad actor too, I have to say. I kept being
a shining star.
Is this guy like somebody's dad or like somebody who like, I was like, is that Don himself? Because like, first of all, he doesn't look the part at all. He's like got a giant bald spot. He looks like just a regular middle-aged Joe, which like maybe the whole dad thing was part of it. But also like he can't act to save his life. Like telling...
Fortunately,
that, like, he doesn't get a tearful goodbye with Dar even.
Right.
Like when they attack the village, he's just dead. He's just gone. and Dar like moves on, right? It's right. Isn't even like a moment where he's like, avenge me or whatever.
Well, that plays in pretty well to what I was about to say about that character, which is he's saved at the last minute by Dar, who unearths his powers by preventing a walking grizzly bear, brown bear, whatever, from attacking and like killing his adoptive father. And at that time, his father reveals to him something, a little bit of information, just this slight exposition. The gods have put their mark on you, and someday you'll find out why, but till then, this mark will be your guide. And it's the mark on his hand. It's the mark of the, you know, Temple of Ar. It's the mark of Ar or whatever. And okay, that's great. That's fantastic. We move on with the scene. Even his father says more things. And then the whole scene comes where the Junes destroy the whole town. The Amorites are dead. He's the last of his kind. He like burns the remainder in a, you know, symbolic show of, you know, moving on or whatever. And he leaves. And in voiceover, a different line from the same guy plays, where he exposes pretty much everything we should have known about Dar up to that point, which is, my sword and my capa will be your true trusted companions. Protect your home. If anything should happen to me, look for our enemies, the Junes, and you may search for your destiny in the Valley of Aruk. And again, I have to wonder, what the fuck are we doing? Why did we not? I would have felt better and more tense about the scene that we just saw if I knew his destiny awaits him. This will put him back, or it will motivate him toward it. But no, we only find out what he's doing in the fucking movie, where he's trying to get back to, how he gets on his, by a rewrite of a previous line that a character has said before. And I don't mean to say like, ah, ha, ha, I got you on a plot hole, but it feels like you're tricking me. Like I wasn't supposed to know this bit of exposition before. For some reason, arbitrarily, this point came in, and I just don't know how that makes it better. I don't really know. Like, it made me frustrated in the moment, and it did not incentivize me to keep wanting to watch. In fact, I thought about it until the end of the movie and then put it in my notes in the podcast that I was going to record about it the next day. Fascinatingly, like, just poor decision making left and right on the writing, with those tiny little flashes of, oh, this could have been a really cool idea. The leathery bird guys among them, I think.
Right. No, I mean, like, that's the thing that's so frustrating about this movie is that the weird hyper specificity of certain elements, which is also like hilariously kind of how I feel about Phantasm, right? Where like Phantasm is also a very broad horror story in some ways, but it has like extremely specific little bits like the ball and like the fact that he's like some kind of demon from like another dimension that harvests suffering or whatever. And like, but that's not the point. Here it's like there are so many good, like, kind of like super weird 80s bullshit like isms in this movie, but they're like supporting what is like an unbelievably broad outline of a story, right? Where it's like I even, Kelly mentioned this, but like I loved the design decisions of Dar's original village, where it's like, even though they're in like a weird New Mexican desert, all of their houses are like on stilts, like up in the air. And so like when they start burning, like they come down really fast and really dramatically. And Kelly was like, why would they build their houses that way? And I was like, it did look cool as hell though. But like, if you're going to do that, right? Like give me something, right? Because like you don't, like instead Dar's village family are like the most broadly written sort of impossibly sort of half-assed. Oh, they're like a barbarian tribe. And like similarly, the Jutes, their enemies are just like, they're basically a Mongol horde, I guess, kind of, that are like vaguely affiliated with this evil religion. Similarly, right? Like this evil religion has all kinds of weird shit going on where they're like putting like radioactive slugs into people's heads to turn them into like leather monsters that go wild and are like stronger than normal men. Cool stuff, like fine stuff, but like we don't learn anything about this cult, right? Like we don't learn anything about who they are, how they came to power. And like I'm not a lore guy, right? Like I'm like, you can tell a story without like getting super deep into lore and everything, but like I don't know. It's something that like, it's one of those things that like this movie gets wrong that Conan gets right, right? Where it's like, you have to gesture at lore the right way to escape broadness without sort of like getting too deep into it. And in this, like, it was so obvious to me when they were taking shortcuts just to sort of like hand wave away elements so they could get at where they needed to go. And where they needed to go was not even interesting, right? It was like, oh, we're going to do like this pretty classic, almost like, you know, like I think that, Cody, something you said that really unlocks this movie for me is that like, I think I would have liked it a lot as a kid, right? Like, I think that, like, it's the right kind of broad hero's journey with a dude who you want to be, right? Like, he's this muscly master swordsman, and he can talk to animals, right? Like, what could be better as a kid? Like, you love animals. You want to be able to, like, commune with them. He gets, like, a cool girlfriend. He gets, like, a cool, like, party, like, posse, and it turns out that he's, like, the king's son, right? It's, like, all of that makes so much sense, and it's, like, so, like, what was the rest of this movie on? Like, why were they, like, why did they make it, like an R-rated movie? And, like, if it was going to be broad, like, be broad that way and be sort of, like, epic and power fantasy. Or if you're going to be something else, if you're going to take sort of a Conan route with it, do that. But it kind of feels like it's, like, a movie by committee that kind of tries to do a bunch of different things at once and doesn't really, like, it doesn't really work, I guess, on any of the levels that it's aiming at, because it's kind of aiming at a lot of different levels. And maybe just in general, because I don't think that the writing or the acting or the directing is there, right? Like, I think that maybe in addition to everything else, like, if this movie starred somebody as charismatic as Arnold Schwarzenegger, which, like, you know, Arnold couldn't do this role, right? So, like, maybe that's part of the problem, is that, like, Arnold is perfect for, like, a stoic Conan. But, like, this guy who's, like, kind of
that horse.
Yeah, very clearly, like, a Luke Skywalker type character, right? Like, a stand-in for the audience. He's supposed to be sort of a charming, if doofy, rapscallion, rascal character that we're supposed to be very charmed by. And it just doesn't get there for me. I want it to, right? Like, but, you know, it's just there's something too broad about it.
Yeah, yeah. I'm glad, like, I know we've been hinting at the whole Conan thing throughout the podcast. How does this sound? Conan works, I think, because the plot is not the story. The story we know is Conan was once enslaved because his people were slaughtered. And for all that he knows, he will be king one day. He has vowed to avenge. He is hired on a completely, seemingly somewhat separate mission. And he wants to leverage that mission to go save the king's, I forget the king's name, but his daughter, to remove her, you know, save her from what is James Earl Jones' character's name in that movie? From the James Earl Jones. And in this movie, it is, I think the plot very much is the story where it's just him and he's going to go to Arik and he's going to fix things. And it just takes so long getting there. And it's not as interesting as it should be. And there aren't, like, pieces that build to that. And there isn't, like, he doesn't even, for all he knows, he doesn't even know who Mayax really is. Like, he has no concept because he was a child, because his father revealed to him, maybe in his dying words, that, you know, what he was even supposed to do with his life as, you know, destined son of the king or whatever. Like, there is nowhere for it to go except straight along this path, straight to Arik. And so everything that comes up, every piece, every, like, side character and story and the potential for, like, better lore is just kind of feels wasted and flat because we're always on that one path. Like, there's nothing that diverges from it. The plot and the story are the same thing. And it just, when the plot kind of flattens out, so does the story. You stop really caring about the story. There's not a whole lot of check-ins with Mayax, for example, that aren't directly mirrored in a scene where he's looking through somebody's ring or whatever. Just mechanically, you don't get the sense that there are things going on in this world, that there are powers that, like, are actually driving people to do things. The Mayax, he's evil and he drinks the blood of children. Literally, that is the story. And that is all that he is, and that is all that he wants to be, and that's all that you ever see him doing. And he only does it in scenes completely, like, tied to the main story. I guess maybe I'm splitting hairs a little bit here, but it feels like to compare these two stories is like one has a large mythos, an interesting sort of world to couch itself in. This one, being that it was adapted from a 1959 novel by somebody who refused to have her name associated with it because it was such a departure, feels like it could have taken more liberties and been even weirder, or been, you know, more mature or more gory or whatever. And it just kind of doesn't ever take those chances in the right ways. And it hews itself far too closely to this main story of, well, everybody cares about Dar. Everybody cares about him getting back to his foretold, like, him fulfilling the prophecy that he maybe doesn't really know about. And then they make Dar the least interesting character in the entire movie, less interesting than, like, sentient animals significantly. And it just doesn't bear that, like, you know, like it can't last 2 hours and be interesting if we're not, you know, if we're not indicating that there could be something more to this, if we're not showing that there could be like, that there are more interesting stories to this, or that there are reasons that these characters are, you know, sort of pulled toward or away from each other. There's just no hint there that there was any like true vision beyond what we're seeing on the screen in the moment to moment. And that just makes it feel empty and flat to me, I guess. I'm just coming right back to the writing, but yeah.
I think that one thing you said at the end there is kind of the key for me in understanding why this movie doesn't work, which is like maybe largely, and I don't want to be like overly simplistic, but like it's 2 hours long, right? It's like this movie really, really deeply doesn't need to be 2 hours long. In fact, I would argue that it's basically four movies in a weird way. It's like the first half hour is the origin of Dar, which should have been cut significantly down because of how broad it is. Like, it's so obvious what it is. But there is some good weird stuff there, right? There's the king with the weird, like, being put into a cow's belly, the weird, like, slimy blue juice that Cody was talking about paralyzing people. That's some good stuff. The second half of this, or the second of these four movies, probably the worst one, is when Dar is an adult and he's like going on solo adventures and kind of like establishing himself, right? There's some good stuff in there too, right? There's Kodo and Podo. Meeting Kodo and Podo is a great scene, even though they put the ferrets in danger, which I really dislike. But it's the movie at its most episodic, when it feels the most like an actual TV show about like this guy's sort of broad adventures. And that is something that makes the movie feel much longer than it has any right to, right? And then once we hit movie three and he meets up with Seth and with Tanya Roberts and with the kid, that's when the movie actually feels like what it was going for all along, right? And that's when the rubber hits the road a little bit. And you're like, why did it take us half of the movie to get to this part? And then Rip Torn dies 20 minutes before the movie's over. And you're like, wait a minute, like, why is the movie still happening? And then there's like this incredibly broad, incredibly boring, supposed to be epic sort of siege with the Junes who destroyed Dar's village or whatever. And this is supposed to be Helm's Deep at the end of this movie, right? And instead it's like half a dozen dudes fighting in a field with half a dozen other dudes, right? I kind of wonder if like maybe that was just sort of like budgetary, if it was just like, hey, like, we don't have a lot of money to like put into these giant epic scenes, so we have to cheat a little bit. And maybe that just showed up. I don't know.
Yeah, I feel that. When I imagine the threads, or just like the trajectories rather, of both Conan and Beastmaster, I see I can picture a straight line for each of them. Granted, those lines are constructed pretty differently, and like, I mean, it would just be me kind of rehashing the sort of things that y'all have characterized pretty well already. But just, you know, Conan already seems like forever ago since we last talked about it, but like I feel like that, like, pretty clear quest for vengeance on Conan's side. Beastmaster, it kind of becomes too kind of concurrent, like he's clearly on a quest for vengeance, but then there's this whole cult thing and it becomes kind of like two concurrent quests, or like quests like nested within one another, right? And that gets like kind of messy, a lot of moving parts, and this is me trying to just like crudely weigh each side, and like by the end, spoilers, they'll like all kind of balance out pretty well the same for me, give or take a few, you know, points, what have you. Conan, you have Arnie to key off of. Even if he's not at his like charismatic best, you can see him kind of working things out like honestly as the movie goes and as production went. Even if the charisma isn't there, there is a magnetism to his presence on screen, in a way that we don't really get with Mark Singer, who is like sculpted. But as we've said, like about both him and Don Coscarelli, like the juice just might not be there. But in absence of Arnie, you have like animal based like adventures, just like quick little vignettes of just, mm-hmm, like we're getting the band together and we're getting into like cute sequences of mischief, centered, like we're like, there are heist sequences in both films. One of them just has animals involved in it, you know, easy peasy screenwriting 101. Shooting from the hip, I feel like I feel like I have a generally more robust understanding of the lore in Conan, if only because, like you guys said, like there's distinct imagery that like that tells a good chunk of the story. Whereas by virtue of the Juns being present and the cult, the rip torn of it all, and also just like the power of speaking with animals, we're gesturing at a way more like at many different like scopes of things without getting to nearly as much of it. And so like, I don't know, all that is to say, like I'm not going to again rehash the like gesturing at lore discussion. But that's well founded. And I think for me, they end up in something of a similar place. The one thing I will say though, that maybe like slides this one way or the other, I don't know if you guys would feel similarly, but like with me, I did not crack Conan the first time I watched it. It took me two tries before I really understood Conan. And I feel like because I was able to watch Conan twice and really come around to it, to appreciating it, I feel like that played really favorably into my interpretation of Beastmaster. And I'm never going to know this for sure, but I feel like if I were to have watched Beastmaster first, even if I didn't love it the first time, or maybe if I did watch it, you know, if it was the inverse and I watched it twice, the second time I really kind of came around to it, I feel like Conan would have gone down a lot better in all of its, it, not that it's a perfect movie or a perfect version of what it's doing. I think both of these films are over 2 hours. Both of them have their kind of like dry and or ill-advised stretches of time, as well as a lot of things to appreciate. But I do think there is something to these works, not to just like come to like a generic kind of whatever compromise, but like I do think there is something to movies within this subgenre kind of like feeding off of each other, and just like the parts may not be great by themselves, but like looking at a bigger picture, like the more of these you watch, I feel like hypothesis is that we get more out of these the more of these that we'd watch, even if they're trash, even if they're worse than these. Like I feel like it builds a more comprehensive picture that I can appreciate better, if that at all makes sense, Jason.
Yeah, no, I mean, it does, because I had the benefit of the first time I watched Conan the Barbarian was for this podcast just a few weeks ago. And like, I had the benefit of knowing that I was going to talk with people who had seen it before and somebody who was really interested in it, and like people who were going to be, I'll say, like smart enough and intellectual enough to like unpack it with me and sort of, if I was missing something, to help guide me to it. So like, I had the benefit of that. And I think that affects Beastmaster significantly negatively, if only by comparison, because now I know like this, if this is the bar for these high fantasy, nearly prehistory style movies, then I'm going to like, I'm not going to be able to get it up for Beastmaster. I think one of the things that you were talking about, I know not to
what?
Not to be able to, I think there might be a lag, so I'm just going to let off all these, all this innuendo. And if somebody says anything later on, maybe I didn't hear it. I think one of the things that you, I know that we said we wouldn't like hint too much at the like larger lore and stuff, but like there's what you were talking about with like stories that are running concurrently and like sort of what's hinted at versus what's shown. I feel like so much is shown that is not that interesting, and that the questions that do ring, or like the things that do interest me, are not really, they're more confusing because they're never like contextualized. Or I'm a big fan of it if it was just like overtly and impressively confusing, or if it like was beyond my ken, but it just seems like bungled in some ways. There are two things that I was hoping I could get y'all's opinion on, because I can't seem to get a whole lot of clarity around. I haven't watched the making of or anything, but like if I ask somebody on the internet, I feel like I might get a number of different answers. On one, we already talked about the fact that he has his powers probably because he came from a cow, right? Is because like he somehow absorbed the ability to communicate with animals because he was born of the womb of one. Fine. Never said in the movie, but intimated. That's fine. The winged devourers, which is the name that like the internet has given those creatures with the leathery arms that absorb people.
No, they're eagle dementors.
Thank
Please
you.
Continue.
The eagle dementors. Cody understands the lore a little bit better than I do. Where the hell did they like? I think it matters to me because they do become such a big part of the story later on. Like Harry was saying, they are literally at the climax. They are the deus ex machina that saves the day. I had no idea why. I didn't really get what their place in the story was until the very end, when they're just suddenly the heroes of the story. But some people on the internet seem to feel that it was because those characters worship.
They worship the hawk that he can communicate with. Yeah, that was the idea. It's not Yes, they are. I also thought that, Cody, very much the Eagles from Lord of the Rings. But I think that when we go to that shrine and he releases that prisoner and then they're about to kill him and he like summons the hawk, I think that that is meant to visually communicate that, like, oh, like they now feel a kinship with him.
Okay.
And because like this hawk is like their buddy or their god or whatever. And so like he can go and send the hawk away to like grab them and have them come help him because like they worship that hawk, and it's sort of like they're the go-between between man and beast, right? So to speak, which means that he's sort of the avatar of them.
that's fair. I guess like their position as midway point between beast and man was not clearly elucidated before me. I thought that they were sort of mindless beasts who he was able to control somewhat because of his beast powers, until of course he's like, they share a meaningful glance at the end where they seem to like have a strange mutual respect for each other, which they do,
which is very good.
It's kind of funny and cool, but like, I guess I got more wires crossed at the scene where they're sneaking into the temple at Auruk and they look down and they're making the priests of Jun or whatever are making a what they call a death guard, which is they put the guy in the mask, they drip blue poison and a leech in his ear, and that stuff looks exactly like what comes out of the external like digestion from the eagle dementors. And I thought for certain we were like, oh, we have now this religious sect, the Juns, they mutate and like torture people into these monsters who then are somehow like freed or have escaped. And there's like a sect of them that has become this other creature. And I thought that's
overthinking it.
That'd be a really cool lore implication. They get their revenge on the Juns and they like have their day. They've retained some element of their humanity despite, you know, no longer being recognized.
Oh, I would have loved that. I would have loved if like the free death guards came to save them at the end. That's a really good idea.
I felt like an idiot for like, am I writing a thing that I just wanted to see in this movie, or did I miss something? So it sounds like I didn't miss anything there, that I just wished it had been somewhat better with no consequence. I wouldn't be losing anything. If that were the way things played out, we wouldn't lose any like essential element of the story. Not to say like I've written what I think to be a better way that that story could be. It's just like, there's one of those hints that I picked up on that I feel like, oh, this could have been really neat. And then it's like, no, actually we've closed off the door to that entirely. Seth is just purely, he's the fact that he's loyal to a king who no longer rules and who is blinded doesn't really matter. He's just a cool monk guy who swings around a stick a lot. There's no real rivalry or controversy between Tal and Dar as like heirs to the throne. Not going to be a problem. Really interesting political idea. Not going to be a problem. Don't worry about it. It's about him like controlling ferrets, and that's fine. But then don't give me the string if you don't want me to pull. That frustrates me a lot, I guess. That's my last big thought about the movie.
Yeah, but that was
this movie wanted you to go brain neutral, and you said, not today, Beastmaster.
I really did. That's for right. Some reason, I broke it out for Beastmaster.
Hey, man, like, we're recording this podcast. I remember thinking, like, relatively early on, it's like, oh, this will be an interesting episode, right? Because usually I, like, try to come to this episode or come to this podcast with, like kind of quote-unquote deep thoughts, right? About, like, what the movie's trying to capital D do, what its themes and its sort of, like, principles are. And that's not how I felt about this movie at all, but kind of for the better, right? I kind of enjoy just talking about, like, silly movies sometimes. I will say that in response to Cody's question, this movie felt really distinctly what I thought Conan was going to be the first time I saw it. And I also didn't grok Conan at all the first time I saw it. I was like, why is this silly adventure movie so serious and so
I remember we were talking about that.
Dour yeah. and so like up its own ass. And like that really worked for me the second time, right? Because I realized like, oh, that's what John Milius wants, right? Like this is a movie that wants to be like serious, or like it wants to be sort of like epic in scale and scope and sort of like fire and brimstone, whereas this movie is like a real light adventure romp in a way that I thought Conan was. And I just like, we can argue, I would argue that maybe it also doesn't do that very successfully, but like that is clearly what it's going for. And I think that you're right, like the same thing that made Conan work well for me on rewatch maybe kind of like upset me about this movie, right? Because it was like, oh, we're going back to like what is basically like a child's like movie, but sort of weirdly scaled up with sexy women in it and stuff. Whereas like Conan ended up being something so much more interesting and so much more than the sum of its parts, just because of its like commitment to its own like dire circumstances, right? So I would agree with that, right? Like, I think that I would rather watch Conan again than this movie, but I almost wonder if watching this movie again, I would be able to find something to appreciate just in the weirdness and in the animal performances. And I wouldn't be quite as bored as I was the first time around, but who knows?
Who knows? Only round two or Beastmaster 2, Beast of the Future. I forget what it's even called. It has one of those super cheesy.
Beast of the Future?
Beast of the Future.
Is that what you're going to say?
It is what I'm
going Beast to say. Of Future Past?
I do want to, because
the Beastmaster Reloaded, if you will.
the Anna Beastmaster. We have, I would rather than end on like, yeah, this movie kind of stank and you shouldn't watch it type note. There is something we've all agreed upon, and it's that there's a significant portion of this movie and the joy that you'll find in it, or at least that I found in it, was watching animals do, frankly, incredible, like, human-like performances and reactions on screen. And I just wanted to open the door for the last, like, talking point to your favorite moments of animal acting, animal performance on this thing, and just things that happened, moments that made you note what was good about that. I have mine, and I'll turn it over to Cody in case he's got his. I'm going to call my shot and say I think it probably includes Kodo and or Podo.
This won't, only because they've gotten so much airtime, so big heads, deservedly, yeah. So and also it's hard to pick out one moment with those two goobers. Anytime like close up on like an empty space, and then like the two of them simultaneously like pop their heads up out of something, it's like, oh god, that's the money shot. So it's not that, and I've already called out my favorite like cat scene, where like the again that like sexy sort of shenanigan that Dar is trying to conjure up, and he's like scaring the cat away, and she's like, okay, no leave, and the cat just like kind of nonchalantly like calmly stands up and walks away, which is like maybe good editing more than anything. But just, I don't know, cat being cool and funny. I wanted to shout out the one that hasn't been mentioned, and that is in sort of my like top tier of like animal bit, is with the eagle. And I think it was the eagle summoning Sako, that like townsperson who I think that was the, and let me know if I've got the name wrong, but like Dar saved or had the eagle save Sako's child. And Sako was the dumbass who brought his child to a child burning ceremony. Kind of ill-advised, but what can you do? You live and you learn. And like the eagle goes back to Sako later, and like just like Sako sees the eagle and he's like, oh no, come on. It's like, I'm a big old coward, like, what? no, tell him I'm not here, tell him I'm busy that day. And then the eagle just has some like cocked head and like little like chittering that it doesn't do with anybody else. That kind of tickled me. I like that sequence.
Phenomenal,
like,
shot also of the eagle carrying the child away, which you only see for just a second, but it is very funny.
Yeah. God, all the animals are just so good. Way better than us three animals. That's for damn sure. Am I right, guys?
I mean, I appreciate your restraint, Cody, in like not making Kodo and Podo the centerpiece of your favorite bit.
I do what I can.
I mean, my favorite acting thing has to be like the scene where they're running away from the beast guard.
Same. That was exactly what tunnel. I was going to say.
Like, we can just hype that up for a moment, because like they are under great duress. This man is screaming, and I don't know what kind of sounds are actually being made on set, but he's like actually flying all around with like an opaque mask on his face. He could have been harming these creatures, and they seem totally in control. Like, they're running away, obviously, in a certain
and they're
panic.
So adorable, and the way so they run, the way their little bodies wiggle.
Ugh. And like one of them is carrying, I think they're carrying a key. It's very funny that they get where they need to go, and then it's totally too late for the key to make any difference. But
well,
like,
and also the door was just unlocked in the first place after they do that whole rigmarole. Yeah,
it's great. And
good physical comedy, guys.
Like the constant, from the moment they steal his like tool belt at the beginning of the movie, well, not beginning of the movie, but when they first meet him, to like this point, the ferrets just have this way of like hopping as they're running away. They just, even if they're just like handling something, even if they need to be making that motion. It just makes them so look much, so mischievous dude. And shitty. It's very, yes. very funny to see them like bounding in front of this like crazed man, this Mad Max looking ass guy down a hallway. It's just a great, great it's like one of the few great sequences in this movie. And it's mostly because of those performances.
Yeah, also, they're the best.
Ruh and I think it's Kodo is left over. I forget who ends up dying.
They do a little
but they
kiss.
Do a little smooch at the end. And yeah. it's like prolonged.
I think Kodo lives. Is it Kodo? But yes, yeah, they have a little smooch. Everybody smooches exactly. at the end, which is really something.
Well, and it was a little bit of a Shrek moment where I was like, wait, did he have those baby ferrets with that tiger? Because like they kissed. But I don't think that was the case. I think that Kodo was their late partner. My favorite part was probably I love the scene where Dar lowers Kodo and Podo down on yeah. the string to like get the keys in the first place, and like they're supposed to be stealthy. He even says like you gotta leave thievery to the thieves, and then like, and it's the most conspicuous shit you have ever seen in your life. Just these two full ferrets being lowered down. And they're noticed immediately. Like, to this movie's credit, like, the guards are immediately just like, what the fuck? Like, there are two big ferrets being lowered down onto us right now. And then there's a great scene where it looks like the ferrets are in danger, but they actually like outsmart a guard and like send him tumbling over a ledge because like they're trying to chew through this rope so that they can open a door, and the guard is about to kill them, but then they sort of like fake him out and dodge out of the way, and he goes flying. And I really loved that part too. And dishonorable mention, of course, to the quicksand scene where one of the ferrets lands in the quicksand, and there is a terrifying moment where it looks like Dar is not going to be able to save him. Hated that
Jesus
shit.
Jesus fucking Christ. No,
none of that. Yeah. Also, weird shout out, bad shout out. They painted the tiger. That's a tiger, real tiger. They just painted it black
oh boy.
For this movie, and apparently it was because Don just, quote, didn't like the stripes, unquote. Like, they were just like, well, it's a panther in the comic books or in the novel or whatever. That led to a longstanding rumor that, in fact, the tiger died from being painted because of the toxicity of the paint that it would try to lick off. Unclear if that's ever true. I have not been able to verify a very authoritative source. I will say the one thing I found about it, because I did a decent amount of research on this because I was distressed about this. Several years ago on a forum, somebody allegedly emailed the people who handled the animals for this movie. And one of the handlers from that movie, or from the company that represented them, said that the stuff that they used to paint the tiger was completely non-toxic, and there is nothing to that rumor. It's a complete sort of fabrication. Again, right, it's sort of like one of those things where, like, probably the company would say that, but also, like... Right. The only sort of authority I have is like internet rumors in either case. So like, who knows what actually happened? I will just say that like it's telling that like that is the sort of rumor that would arise from a movie like this, where it's like, it's 1981. You don't know exactly what kind of standards there were. And there's a whole lot of stuff in this movie that definitely looks like unsimulated animal duress. Right. So yeah, it's sort of like, maybe not like if you really like, if that kind of stuff really bothers you, some trigger warnings here for that. I think it's pretty tame ultimately. Like, yes, one of the ferrets dies heroically, but like, it's pretty clear in that case that like he dies off screen, right? He just drops out of frame basically. There are just a couple of moments that are maybe going to piss you off. I mean, painting a tiger black sucks, right? Like, don't do that. Like, especially because like, it's a fucking tiger. Like, what do you mean you don't like the stripes? Like, perhaps the most natural.
Yeah, tigers by design look objectively cool.
Fucking amazing. Mr. Coscarelli. Especially like on camera. It's like maybe the most like
right.
a camera ready animal that there is. And he's just like, nah, make it less cool looking. It's like, all right, you fucker.
Yeah, that scene with Kodo sinking is I thought they would cut before his little face goes all the way under.
I hate
the
it
wet
so
sand.
Much, dude.
It's truly like abominable. I mean, it's effective. It did make me clench every muscle in my body, but it's
a save the ferret moment, if you will. Truly. It does make you like Dar more. And he also, Dar has that really great line where like they're escaping from the temple and he's like, I can't leave without my little ones. I was like, oh, he called his ferrets his little ones. Yeah, very good stuff.
It's great. Well, that was, I think, our last discussion point. I'll open up. Where's my sound? The junk drawer for any little thoughts. My only little thought is, good Christ, Rip Torn's big ass fake nose rivals for certain Anthony Quinn's in Lawrence of Arabia for the most egregiously like ethnic nose uncomfortable thing they've just slapped onto the middle of his face. Did it catch anybody else completely off guard? Because like
it's rough. Yeah, I was. Yes. I was pretty taken or repulsed by the teeth that they had on him. Classic 80s thing. You want to make a guy disgusting, just give him fucked up teeth. Did a great job with that. But yeah, the nose is also a lot to take in.
Yucky, yucky. Any junk drawer thoughts that didn't fit in the main discussion?
My only one, it'll be quick. It was shortly after the animal communication powers were revealed in that bear Tease, their buddy, RIP to a real one, question mark. Mm-hmm. But I just wrote down Doc Dar Doolittle. Thank you.
Nice. Wow. Mm. Got him. I love that scene with the bear because the bear walks like what feels like a quarter mile on just its hind legs. And it looks so funny. And like, I know that in real life that would be intimidating as fuck, but like something about, maybe it's just like associating it with circuses or something, but like watching a bear walk on two legs is so funny to me, and it really killed the dramatic tension of that scene, just that this bear was just like bebopping towards him on two legs and he was like, hey, I'm gonna come fuck you up. It was really good. I thought Mark Singer looked uncannily like it helps that like they're pretty clearly going for a Luke Skywalker thing here, but he looked like a really buff Mark Hamill like crossed with Kevin Bacon. And he even kind of sounded like Kevin Bacon to me, and that really got to me. And I was like, huh, like, I wonder what about this performance isn't working for me, because I kind of like the idea of a guy who is like very markedly not Conan, right? Instead, he's like a charming sort of like trickster hero who like has these animal friends that he loves and like is like very good hearted, but also sort of mischievous. But Mark Singer just didn't work for me. And then I guess my last juncture thought is just Tanya Roberts is super hot in this movie. She looks a lot like Isabel Adjani, I think, in a lot of ways. And, you know, I appreciate that.
Somehow when she puts her armor on, it's like that JRPG effect where it actually like, she's visibly less clad than she was in her tattered, you know, peasant
especially
rags.
Yeah. Well, and then like later on she's recaptured and they have her in like a slave garb, and the slave garb is like the most sort of like busty, mm-hmm. like model outfit you've ever seen. And it's like, huh, why would they put the slaves in that?
Makes you think. Speaking of Marks looking like other Marks, Mark Singer, the first comp I thought of was Mark Pellegrino, who is Jacob on Lost. That's, I don't know, in case that does anything for anybody listening to this episode, I wanted to shout out another Mark that looked like some other Mark. Shout out to Marks everywhere, I think.
And we're the biggest ones for watching this fucking movie. I don't know. Can anybody hear me? There is one shot.
Yeah, you're right.
I want to leave a quick, I want you guys to look at this image that appears on the splash screen for, the Beastmaster on the Trilon's listing for it. Every time that I saw this image, I thought for certain I was looking at a picture of Bruce Willis in the 1980s. I'd like the same way that it struck you guys so closely to other.
Doesn't even really look like Bruce Willis to me in this movie.
I really got Bruce Willis vibes off of this picture. That's what I
can kind of see it in this picture.
Well, that'll close up the junk drawer. We have another bit before we get to our final bit. It's called To All the Loves We've Tried Before. In episode 40, we had The Thing. Episode 115, Pink Floyd's The Wall. Episode 142, Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, another Halloween Horrorthon that we covered with Seth Zerotti, the fifth one, back in 2021. Fitzcarraldo, episode 146. We have no thoughts about that movie at all. 216 was on Chan is Missing. And then most recently, we have two episodes, both with guests. 263 about Burst City with Blake Hester. And then 274, very, very recently, a movie we've already covered or discussed so many times in this episode, Conan the Barbarian with Celia Madison, also came out this same year. So check out both those, all those movies.
What was in the water in 1982, by the way, that like these like scantily clad muscle dude sword and sorcery movies were happening? Like specifically, I wonder, there's probably a really good thesis statement to be written about that, but I'm not the one to write it.
It seems like maybe there was, what's that effect. Like maybe there was generationally back in like the 50s and 60s pulp stories and some of the stories that like became these, you know, in the teens you had the Conan stories, in 59 this story The Beastmaster was written, and it's like with enough time somebody will discover it and option it for a movie, and it'll like get enough play
and like, you know, maybe just the cyclical like circulation back around to like conservative ideals of masculinity, right? Mm-hmm. Like the 80s were definitely a marked time for that after the 60s and 70s, something like that.
Newly remarkable. On. Yeah, for sure. There's something to be said for it. We'll got to pitch the trial on whatever kind of series name that ends up being, like toxic masculinity, money in the bank, baby.
Yeah. It's called Of Swords and Sorcery, and it's playing right now at the trial.
Cha-ching. Check it out at trylon.org. Thank you so much for engendering wonderful discussion. We have one final thing to do on this show, and it is a little segment that we like to call I Need Harry's Help to Ring It In.
Do we ever. It is the finest segment on the show, the segment we like to call
Cody's Noties.
Amazing. Thank you, gentlemen, for that incestuous introduction. Today, we're going to be chatting about animals through a little something I like to call Phylove, which comes from phylum, you know, that tier of animal taxonomy classification, kingdom, phylum,
this
class,
might be my
family,
favorite
genus, species.
Cody's Noties segment name maybe ever.
Wow.
I don't know what it's going to be like, but it's in the running.
Yeah, we'll see. Kind of a change of pace, I think, all things considered. This is going to be a pretty loose setup. There no stakes, purely discussion-based. We're just going to be roundtabling a few animal specific topics. I don't know. I didn't want to compose any stakes. Also, when it's just the three of us, or like, you know, a game with you two participating, sometimes that works if I can like really hone in on like a good idea. But this time around, especially with me,
the
like,
competition is always
week,
just between me and Aaron anyway. So you figure that when Aaron's not here, I kind of win by default. That's fair. I'll take the W. Thank you.
Literally not what I said at all. Again, there are no stakes here, so if you have any of those sorts of jabs, get them out now, gentlemen. So I'm gonna just throw some questions out there. Again, mild discussion topics relating to animals. First one being, and they're all gonna spoilers be somewhat tethered to the subject matter of this movie. Is question one: if you were a superhero, or you know, some mythical being, perhaps upon which a movie or a franchise might be based, somewhere on that level, if you were a superhero and could have one animal sidekick, what type or species of sidekick would you have? I have one in mind. I think it's kind of a weird pick to set the tone with, so I'm not gonna. If either of you want to kind of like take the lead and think out loud, I will definitely insert my pick. Maybe I'll like go first the next time.
God, just, this is a good question, Cody. This is like, yeah, it's yeah, gonna take some time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah. What are you thinking about? Is the cogs
right,
turning?
Yes.
Well, what are your criteria?
Very top of mind. I love raccoons. I love raccoons. Are like one of nature's most charismatic beasts to me. They're so rascally, and I feel like kind of similar to Kodo and Poto, but just like bigger and with opposable thumbs. Right. Like I could get into so many like different like hilarious situations with a raccoon buddy. I might have told this story on the podcast before, but once at my last apartment, I was walking home from work and I was walking up this slope and I came across two raccoons, and one of the two raccoons jumped perfectly with like perfect acrobatic dexterity straight into a sewer grate to get away from me. And the other one, seeing what his friend did, like about a second and a half later, tried to like run slash climb up this little embankment, this little like pretty low fence, failed to do so, landed on his little raccoon ass, and then just sort of like open mouth discouragedly watched me walk by him because he was sort of like, well, I didn't get away. And like that, the sort of like the tale of two raccoons and the personality contained in that moment has really stuck with me and made me love raccoons a lot. So I think raccoons is probably my answer.
Pretty good pick. Jason, where do you fall in this topic of the times?
I'm like, I would love to punt back to you in case something rattles around in my brain, but the first thing that comes, like, I won't subject myself to that level of like, I won't let myself off the hook like that. I must own up to the fact that I'm just boring as shit. And I think like literally just for the versatility, for the bonding ability, for the like, you know, the attack power. Just get a fucking coyote or something. Like have basically a canid creature. You know, a
gotta love a big dog.
Something.
Yeah, like big dogs rule.
I want to say, because I'm far more afraid of like water based creatures than most, like, you know, even larger mammals than me. If I'm like on a scale here, I'm way more afraid of like a gator or a big old Komodo dragon or something than I am of, you know, a wolf on four legs or a bear on two, you know, like it just objectively. But that has very limited use if I'm stuck on land.
Yeah, you don't want to be an Aquaman, right? Right. That's the problem with the sea creatures.
Right. Yeah. Right. So I gotta say, like, just, you know, the biggest wolf that you can imagine is going to be my sidekick, because he can go where I go and more. He can rip things apart. He can follow the sound of my voice. He can alert me to things. Metal Gear Solid 5 taught me that he can even help, like, pick out and mark guys in crowds, and like keep track of them for me. Thank you, Cody.
For sure. Definitely.
Just making sure that you would turn off
D-Dog, one of the best companions in that game. He's very good.
Couldn't agree more.
After I unlocked him, I don't know that I used anybody else. Like, quiet, very useful, me very too. Helpful. Nothing. Ain't got shit on D-Dog. Anyway.
Yeah. If the Game of Thrones, the time of Game of Thrones, and just like dire wolves taking over. I mean, they didn't really like take over the culture, but always one of like the best parts.
They're the cultural show, reference. Like, yeah.
A huge, like a wolf that's like two times or he's three times.
He's big and he's your friend.
It's like, oh yeah, let's fucking go. And some of them are like untamed and they're like reflective of the personality and like the trajectory of like the fate of each of the Stark children. That's the
socially respectable shit in the world. Yeah.
Yeah. I couldn't have said it better myself. I didn't anticipate falling upon this when I like conjured up this question, but I got to thinking about it, and something about like wanting to, like, I think it was you, Jason, who said like can go places that I can't. And for like an animal sidekick, they gotta be airborne. Like there has to be flight involved.
Great point.
And that is like, especially if from the perspective of like a hypothetical superhero, I don't think I'm a naturally like physically imposing person. So I would want my sidekick to like maybe bring some of that heat and just like, you know, have that air of like, you know, oh, shit's afoot. Not like from, you know, a villainous perspective, although my pick ended up landing on a vulture.
Oh,
big ass bird. And like, I'm always sympathetic to animals that is, God, this is so stupid. Like I've become sympathetic, especially just like hunkering down with some like weird, like COVID time pics of just, and really thinking about like, you know, film, like the history of cinema has really done some animal, like types of animals dirty.
It's
like,
true. Yeah.
Like snakes are really cool, but just they're always chalked up. Just like, it's always like the Slytherin bullshit or just like evil equals snake equals evil. And just like animals that get like routinely villainized and like vultures being like, you know, tethered to like carrion and animal corpses and stuff like that, you know, being like the animal angels.
They're only
of death.
Ever at the, like, when you're at your lowest, right? It's like when the protagonist is about to, like, they're dying and it's like even the fucking the vultures are circling, right?
Yeah. And so part of my heart kind of calls out to them in that sense. And then way more importantly, within the last I guess it was a year ago at this point, I revisited Jackass Forever. There's a stunt involving like a vulture eating raw meat out of someone's pants or something like that. And I can't, they're in a similar sort of category as like bats for me. It's just like, I don't know, when you like get right down to it, they're like kind of cute, like misunderstood winged creatures that are like kind of cute. I don't know. There's at least you in, can that, also, in that skit. Yeah, go ahead.
It's a real like badass. Like you could be like a dark Western themed character, because it's like, totally. Oh, like before you arrive on the scene, the bad guys see the vulture land and it's like, oh fuck, like we're about to be carrion or whatever. Right. It's very similar to Batman. Yeah.
Carrion Cody. Exactly.
They're imposing. They are in many ways, like, you know, sort of a Western goth type thing. Are they fast? Would they be able to lead where, you know, where you need to go?
Yeah, that's a fair point. And as somebody who, like, in video games, I always err on the side of, like, speed. Now that everybody else is going dark. I don't know. It would put more pressure on me to, like, up my cardio and improve my sprint speed, if anything else, as an athlete.
They got huge wingspans. Like, the thing they about do. Vultures they're is so they're big, much dude. Bigger than you think they are, which is, like, really? Another oh, yeah. great point in favor of vultures, right? Is they're one of those animals that's sort of like wolves, where it's like, when you think of a wolf, you think of, like, a coyote, but a little bit bigger. And then you see a wolf, and it's like, oh, right. that's three times the size yeah. of the biggest dog I've ever seen.
Yeah. Right. You're imagining a husky, like, undoubtedly. And just like when, for like, sure. a actual wolf is much bigger, right?
And that's the thing that I think I respect most about vultures as a choice is, like, evolution has done all the work for you of making that thing really fucking scary. Like, his beak yeah. rips. He needs to be able to rip raw and rotting meat apart on his own, you know, like there's no improvement on him. Maybe you'd be able to communicate with him, but that's really between yeah, you and him, out. You know,
yeah. maybe you just, like, fucking Prometheus their asses too. Right. Like, maybe you leave your, sure. your victims Cody alive them up. And then, like, you just have the vulture go at them. Right. And they're just like, no, please God, no, you know?
Yeah, I'd be more of an anti-hero. But on the note of great answers, everybody. On the note of this idea of communicating with animals, we'll pivot to question two, which is, if you could have the capability to converse with, not necessarily like control, but just, you know, telepathically communicate with, much like our friend the Beastmaster, with one species of animal, what species would that be? I'll kick this off. Just to give you more time to think, I think this is maybe a more complicated question than the first one, which is just, like, you know, the cutest, best, like, most optimal animal that we know. I landed upon crows, and I couldn't really think of anything else to like, it's that classic internet thing where it's, you see, like, somebody tweet about, with, like, a screenshot of somebody on Reddit or whatever. That's like, oh yeah, like, I fed a crow in my neighborhood and now I've got, like, an army of crows. And it's like,
just like constant yeah. stories of crows displaying near human intelligence.
Right. Like, that's the thing. I would want to communicate, like, just like me going all like these different thought exercises. And it's like, imagine, like, being able to communicate with, like, a species where there's like a shitload of, like, ants, yeah, like Ant-Man, but just, like, I don't know, like, are ants actually that smart? Like fish, like, there, even just going broadly with fish, just like outside of, or like animals that swim, we'll say that, we're like, we know dolphins are smart, but, like, am I around dolphins all that much? Would I really be able to, like, leverage that without making it my livelihood?
Yep.
It is the Aquaman thing, but also, like, horses, like, I'm not actively around horses. I would need to act, like, reframe my entire life to be, like, a horse girl, you know, just, like, be around horses and, like, maximize that power. Whereas, like, crows are in my neighborhood, they're commonly found all over the place. That's something that I feel like that's a flavor of animal communication that I could leverage without, like, making it my entire personality or having to, like, rework all the cool shit I've got going on in my life. That was dripping with sarcasm, but, you know, like, it would fit into, and maybe you two fellas answer this, and, like, you pick something where it would involve you kind of, like, reworking different mechanisms of your life to accommodate that power, which I totally respect, and I would be excited to hear about that. But ultimately, I landed upon crows just because it fits into this weird cross section of, like, cool, could make use of it on, like, the scale that I see myself being able to just with the life that I currently have. And, like, smart animal that would maybe be fun to telepathically communicate with.
I love that.
That's kind of where I ended up. Yeah. And
it's a great choice. With it
however you'd like. Yeah. Just, how does this question hit you? What would you pick?
Well, I'm just going to add a little bit more respect to the crow thing, because not only are you communicating with the crow, but presumably they can communicate with others, with other crows. And then your name gets around.
You've got a whole network.
And you've got a network. You have a reputation. You ain't never done nothing
wrong
to a
crow. You're basically Saruman.
Yeah. You feed one of them a fry one time, sure. And you are just, you're Lisa Nalgaib to them. You are one of their favorites. You are their hero. I love
that. Take over the world, you'll be spared.
Now, God, I can't wait. Are we mean a bunch of crows? It's going to be fun. Go ahead. Sorry.
As asked, did the question specify if it has to be kingdom animalia? Is that the Beastmaster rule?
I don't know. If it feels wrong, we'll call you on it. How about that? I don't want to, like, put too many rules on this question, but yeah, I would say, like, shit, if you want to go, you know, all of the fish.
Yeah. I mean,
if you want to be Aquaman.
if you're about to hit us with, man, I wish I could communicate with people, we're gonna ding you for that.
Roast you so hard.
Anything outside of that is pretty good.
Well, I was just gonna I'll give two answers. My number one, if I could communicate with an organism that isn't necessarily in Kingdom Animalia, I found out they're in Kingdom Monera, bacteria. I would love to know what the fuck is going on down there. I want to know if you have ancestral memory, if you have genetic memory, what's going on. If you can tell me I assume we can figure some of these things out as humans who have like observational powers, but to know what it's like to be one, to know what like existence is like from down there, I would love to know that.
You talk to your first bacteria. It's like, hey buddy, how's it going? And it's just like,
Well, that's what I'm saying, is that I almost respect it, because that sounds like existential horror on a level that I can barely comprehend. Like, you're walking everywhere and you're like, oh, there's 100 million living organisms that I just stepped on. And like, they have no idea what's happening, except that now they do, because I've like freed them from their inability to communicate.
I would absolutely love to do that. If not them, then, oh my God. The other one that I picked is spiders, and I don't think they're in Kingdom Animalia either, are they?
Is that close enough? It fits within the... I think that...
I would love to communicate with spiders, because, again, one of my least favorite emotions in the entire world is seeing a spider up in the corner of the room and saying, you're cool, please don't come near me. Like, you're fine in that corner. I respect you. You can even procreate up there. As long as you're not near or on me, I am fine. But as soon as you're within, like, you know, my arm's reach, I have to assume that you're here to do me a will, and I can't confirm or deny that because I can't communicate with you, so you die. And I imagine, like, I'm going to have that experience someday. I'm going to be on the wrong end of some supernatural being or somebody larger than me. I'm just going to be close enough, and they're not going to be able to determine my threat level, and they're just going to have to kill me. So if I could communicate that with spiders, maybe I could learn how to, like, position myself better when eventually something comes to kill me, when those big guys from Prometheus are around, like, the next stage of human evolution, and I'm, like, on the squishing block. Maybe I can avoid that fate a little bit. That's why
is making me almost want to pick centipedes for like the same type of reason. Those are like the household insect that I dislike encountering the most.
I fucking hate house centipedes. I've had to write so many blogs about them, and like every single other type of bug I came around on, and I'm a big bug guy. I love bugs. House centipedes and me still do not. I can't fuck with them.
I still think about your trivia about their little pokey
arms.
Dude,
it sucks so bad. They've got little poison arms that they can stick you with. Oh, the worst thing. They're the worst. I thought about house centipedes just so I could be like, fuck off. whenever they had
Brian Cox impression. Yeah, nice.
That's my Brian Cox. Anytime they got near me. But I didn't think about bugs. I'm jealous, Jason. My first answer, I'll also do too, is boring because it's just cats. If I could do like all kinds of cats, including big cats, that'd be great. But specifically house cats, just because there's never ever been a cat that I've seen that I haven't wanted to have a conversation with, especially if they're like kind of grumpy assholes, like Miyazaki cats, you know, just like a big cat who doesn't want anything to do with you. Because like the whole conversation would probably be like, how you doing? And they'd be like, fuck off, which would be fine. But like every time I see a cat, I'm like, I wonder what they're up to. I wonder what they're thinking about. I wonder what their day's going like. I would love to love to hear from the cats. And then also possums. Kind of for the opposite reason, where it's just like, I would love to be like a hero to possums, because I feel like they really have a raw deal, where like they're constantly getting their ass kicked by like all of nature, including just weather. Like possums, I don't know if you know this, but like possums live all over the world, and like they don't survive in low temperatures very well. So like lots of possums freeze to death every year, and that really bothers me. Like I hate thinking about that.
Bummer.
I would love to just sort of like be a friend to possums and just be like, hey man, here's where you're gonna go. Like we're gonna hang out, like you're gonna be all right. I think a lot about possums for some reason. They're just so defenseless and dopey, and I want to help, you know?
Yeah. Those are great picks. And honestly, I thought about the category of animals, like house pets, and I kind of landed up, like, it would be great to be able to communicate with like dogs or cats, and like.
Dogs is huge, right? Because when you take dogs for walks, like, I want to know what they smell. so bad.
Yeah.
Because like there's a whole universe there of context that you do not have access to that is like, oh, like you are sensing like every like creature that's around here right now, you know, and that would be so fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. I kind of come at it from a different angle where like, by and large, love dogs, love cats. Like, I don't align myself with like, oh, I'm a dog person, I'm a cat person. Just like, I don't, they're all great. Like, what the fuck are we talking about? And like, I feel like by and large, I kind of get what I need to out of a relationship. It sounds gross when I say it, but like, I get what I need to out of a relationship with like any one dog or cat. Mm-hmm. Like, I kind of get a sense of like what makes them tick, whether I don't, you know, if I'm annoying them or like we've like develop a bond, whatever the case might be. But specifically for like the handful of dogs or cats where I come across where like we haven't necessarily like gotten off on the right foot, being able to like troubleshoot those relationships, like Emily's cat Sufjan, like it was when it, like he stayed with me for a week or something. It was a couple days.
Kind of a dick.
Yeah, kind of a real asshole. But like being able to like, you know, for the first like 48, 72 hours, like get in his head and be like, hey man, like what can I do to like is this just like a rough transition and I gotta wait it out? And like everything was gravy eventually. It was just like him getting used to the environment. But like if I can like help make a dog or cat's experience with me better, like get to the, you know, like I'm not going to resolve any like trauma with like a foster dog or cat's like relationship with a horrible owner, but like being able to like empathically understand that would I think be helpful. That's, I don't know, that's the kind of shit that I would love from that. But I don't know, crows undisputedly my number one, unfortunately. Those winged crazy little fucks.
I like crows more and more as a choice every time when I come back to it. I will say I have the exact inverse opinion on communicating with house animals. I benefit greatly from making assumptions about dogs and about cats that usually pay off or allow me to define that relationship a little bit better. I think it's kind of what you were talking about a little bit. We're like, yes, it'd be really nice to know if I'm going to like fuck their life up or if I'm like really ruining their in like, that moment. But generally, like,
what if like
I'm pretty well like positively, yeah. I approach a dog and a cat with like best intent. You're a good dog. You're a good boy. You're a good girl. And if I learned that they were not in
what
some
if
respect,
Abe's racist?
What if Abe, like I get to map oh, any, I get to map all these I nice wonderful traits to kidding. Abe, and like what if he's an incredible right? What if he's just an ethnicist? I don't want to find that out. I don't want to have that confirmed. I want to risk having that confirmed. I don't know.
You start communicating with Abe, and he calls you a slur immediately, and you're just like, what the fuck, Abe?
I also don't know why I didn't answer with Galapagos turtles. I want to know what they know about the world 110 years ago.
They're, oh, sure. Yeah, they're ancient and wise beasts. Oh, it's true.
That's fantastic.
Good Dark Horse candidate.
It would be.
Dang.
What if they were mostly like, there's some really good krill on the underside of that dock there.
I've been over there once in my 100 years, but it was the best meal of my life.
That's all they talk about. They're like the person that only references like one restaurant and the reference right. and the restaurant is Taco Bell and that person is me.
It's like, oh, there's some really good shade over there at around 4 o'clock. It's like, all right.
Well, great. Yeah, anything else? Nope. That's it.
I could learn something from his simplicity and his way of life.
That's beautiful, Jason.
God, when you put it that way. Excellent discourse. We've got one more question. Slightly nastier, but
oh no,
kind of an appropriately bonkers.
I wouldn't want to fuck any animals, Cody. I think it's disgusting that you
thank
asked
you very much for listening.
All right, then I guess we're done. I can't remember. If I've approached this topic of conversation with y'all off mic or if it was with other other people that let me ask these fucked up questions. But my question for y'all is: what is the largest animal you believe you could defeat in hand-to-hand combat, just like no external weapons, whether not necessarily by you like punching them, but just like you versus them, final destination, no weapons, that sort of thing. I'll feel free to take time to think about it. I will give the same answer that I always give in people kind of, I don't know. People don't always vibe with it. My pick is alligator. Yeah, it's big. I'm going to be on land. I'm not going to be in water for this, where they would assuredly
not a
have
crocodile,
the upper hand.
But a,
not a crocodile. Yep. I did specify. I'm specifying that. I did look it up this time. In my head, they're always like one in the same crocodiles.
No, crocodiles are much bigger.
Crocodiles are bigger. They have the most powerful jaws in the animal kingdom, supposedly. And so I'm giving myself that. Like, I'm not going to hype myself up too much. I'm going to settle upon alligators. They don't turn very well. I feel like I could outquick an alligator. I could turn it around, maybe, you know, confuse it, get it turned around in circles. And ultimately, I think I could like pile drive it like Mario on a Goomba or some shit. I don't know where these video game references are coming from all of a sudden. But that's, I think I could make that work. If it was like a do or die scenario, or a hand to hand combat scenario, which is the literal prompt of the question. But again, alligator, not crocodile, too big. Probably I would need to spend some time at the gym, but that's, I'm sticking with alligator. Maybe a little presumptuous, you know, maybe a little haughty of me, but that's what podcasts are for. What do you guys think you could defeat in combat animal wise?
I think that I could take down like a large deer, maybe something shorter, smaller than a reindeer. Cause I know reindeer and moose are like gigantic shits, like way bigger than you think, you know, prehistoric.
I think we need to factor in, and I should know this as someone in a family full of hunters, but like deer with antlers versus like,
I knew you'd ask or something, and I didn't have an answer. well, like ideally doe, because yeah, that's pretty lethal. Like get one good in on me and you know, my lung is punctured and
one
shit.
Kick and you're done.
Right.
Yeah.
But the thing that I understand about unguits, what do they call them? Like the creatures with like stock, you know, bony legs, essentially, you know, like dogs and deer and boar and shit, whatever, like hoofed and pawed, bipod.
Okay.
Whatever, you know, characteristics.
Bipod.
Yeah, bipod. Like getting them and like wishboning their arms is a really good way to disable, like potentially kill, but like disable them. So that is all you'd really need is like a good angle. And I think the only reason I didn't answer like a wolf is because like his teeth could probably reach me while I'm trying to do that. But with a deer, they're not made for killing, you know, red blooded animals. They're made for eating plants and shit. I think I could probably make that happen with one of them if, you know, the adrenaline's really flowing and we're on even ground and stuff. I think I could probably take down a decently sized deer. I will say, just for safety's sake, no antlers. So yes, I'm just talking about destroying a female deer for no particular reason. But that, I think, is that's as haughty as I want to be about this one.
It was you or her.
Yeah,
you weren't there.
What could you do?
You weren't fucking there. I really do.
Antlers is a crazy X factor. Just like, I'm really glad you went the route you did. That's like, that increases the difficulty. No,
thank
thrice
you. Thank you for splitting that hair. I highly respect the alligator. I think even the alligator is nearly completely hubristic. Let's hope this never comes to pass, because I'll write, but I don't know if I could deliver your eulogy. It would be to fight an alligator.
If it happens and it works out in my favor, I will have the coolest story anybody has ever had. Also, it's me and Happy Gilmore in the same sort of company. Like, if that alligator bit the hand of like my mentor, then a fucking course I'm
it's on
taking
site,
that alligator to task. Yeah. Harry, what, how about you?
All right, so
let us into your
do I get any training time is what I want to ask, because I think hear me out here.
Go for it.
You give me a month in the gym, in the boxing gym. I've seen kangaroos box. All right,
I was afraid somebody was going to say kangaroo, man.
Listen, they've got the reach, they've got the strength. I don't think that they put any development into the fundamentals. I've seen them box. It's some amateur shit. They don't know how to jab.
They
don't know lead. They don't know how to block. I'm just saying the positioning is all off.
I'm continue to entertain this, but I want to jump in here. Just like, I think that you see like photos online sometime of like jacked kangaroos with biceps. That is not the norm.
They're arrogant. That's what I'm saying.
They are arrogant.
There's an arrogance to them.
But then you pivot your attention downward. If they get kind of like deer or any of those types of animals that Jason was talking about, get one kick in, you're absolutely
fucked.
The kick
is the tough part. That's the like special move that I'd have to watch out for. But like,
yeah,
if I'm boxing, a kangaroo, and I've got like you give me a trainer for a month. You tell me keep the blocks up, you know, lead with the jab, like look for the opening, let your opponent make the mistake, the sweet science. I think I'm pulling it off. I think that I'm going a couple rounds with kangaroo. Let's see.
Oh boy.
A little bit more arrogant picks. I think a single wolf. I think I could have a climactic battle with a single wolf. Like if he's got buddies, I'm
climactic
fucked.
In like, his favor.
I think we would both be fucked up, and I think I would come away. I just maybe on the brink of death.
All right.
And finally, a hammerhead shark specifically. I think that like,
you would get in the water and take down a hammerhead shark.
Sure. Yeah. Look at those big weak points.
Actually, yeah, that's it.
He's got
that's,
big weak points.
That's your best pick of the three for what it's worth. Yeah. The fact that its eyes, like its periphery is so messed
up. And listen, like you said the biggest animal. Like, yes, the odds are against me. I think that I'm pulling it off. Like I think that I'm the dark horse in all. Maybe that's number four, a dark horse. Maybe I could fight a dark.
All right. A horse that's been painted in black paint.
Right, exactly.
Why is he painting up a painted horse?
He's confused and maybe a little intoxicated from the fumes that I got him.
You just need to wait him out. He just stumbles away from the battlefield and dies in the corner because of the toxic fumes.
Oh boy. All right. Well, with that, I invite anybody listening to this borderline farce. No, this has been great. Thank you, gentlemen. This has been Phylove. Reply, quote, retweet, let us know what animal you could beat up or who you would have as a sidekick or who you'd want to talk to on a species level. It's fun to think about nonsensical things sometimes, but also this is maybe these are perhaps the most important questions of our lifetime. So think about that. Jason, take it away.
I am thinking about that. You know what that is? That's what we in the marketing business call a CTA. And here's another. You should keep listening to episodes of Trilove. We've probably covered a movie or a couple movies you've seen. Check it out in the backlog. Thank you, Cody, for ending our episodes, as always, on a lighthearted, joyful note about killing defenseless animals. Well, some of them are naturally defenseful.
Defeating in combat. Does
defeating
not,
in combat. They understand.
I mean, I did literally say pile drive an alligator like Mario on a Goomba. So that alligator is probably dead. But, you know, you don't have to kill him if you don't want to.
I just need to make him tap the ground three times. He submits.
Oh, I'm out.
That's the sound of the deer that you
I'm going to go eight rounds with the kangaroo and win by decision.
Hey, mate, you win this round.
They're like, Harry got him more jabs. He's got a higher score than the kangaroo does.
And you should check out our backlog for other movies. Check out the Trilon's website for more tickets and other cool showings and series coming up. I believe we are just about to head into the Charlotte Rampling series, if we're not already. Her Illusions of Invulnerability is the theme for the standout calendar theme of the Trilon for the spring. But hey, more ones will be coming out for summer and fall and long.
That would also be the name of the expo fight between me and the kangaroo would be Harry Mack and Illusions of Invulnerability.
You know, long live the Trilon, long live Harry in his incredibly heuristic kangaroo fight. You know, I wonder if it makes a difference if you're in Oceania or if it would be like
if he's got home field advantage, I'm fucked.
Probably.
Definitely.
Yeah. Air is just different there out in the bush.
Yeah, absolutely.
Picnic and hanging rock ass choice. Thank you so much for listening. You can find us on Twitter at Trial of Podcast, find the Trilon at Trilon Cinema and at Trilon.org. Like I already said, I'm Jason Daphnis. You can find me on Twitter at Nintendoofus.
Yes, thank you, everyone. If you're an alligator and come at me in a dark alley, it's on site. I've been Cody Narvison. You can find me on Blue Sky at Cody Narvison and on Twitter at Cody_BH.
And I'm just saying, the odds are long, but you bet on me and you could come out a much richer person. That's all I'm going to say about Harry Mack and Illusions of Invulnerability. I've been Harry Mack, and you can find me on Twitter at PunishTalk.
I have my eyes. I have my cunning. And now, I have strength.